5. It was the 5th of August, a day hot with the dull intensity that ends in storm. Since dawn, the fields had baked in sunlight. The lake lay glassy. The sun was warped and reddish in the sky, pale with heat. Crickets sang in the mown and the yellow fields, in the orchards, under the oaks. Shadows now touched the lake from the western peaks, and there was a softer color low in the sky, a vague blue-violet. But still no wind rose, and Malafrena lay like a bowl of heat and light. Piera Valtorskar was coming downstairs, an action that to her, in this huge, timeless afternoon of August, seemed to last a long while, an interval full of intangible thoughts and manifold sensations. The house, built of limestone and marble, was cool. One knew it was a hot day only by the dryness of the air, the cricket chant, the molten glare of a sunstreak finding its way through a shuttered window. Piera was wearing the women's dress of her province, a full dark red skirt, black vest, linen blouse embroidered at the neck. The sleeves of the blouse were stitched at the shoulder into 12 pleats. It had been made in Val Malafrena. A blouse made in Val Altesma would have gathered sleeves, and certain motifs and stitches of the embroidery would be different, a flower design instead of a pattern of birds and branches. All these things were as they should be, as they had always been, so Piera preferred this dress to any other. As she descended the stairs, she was smoothing out the skirt, aware of the garnet color, feeling the cool, grainy texture of the homespun cloth. Her right hand was on the marble stair railing, soap slick and cold. Step by step she descended, feeling herself descend, feeling the heavy skirt sway, feeling the railing under her hand, thinking of a great deal, though she could not have said what. On the fourth step from the bottom she began to hum the song, "Red Are the Berries on the Autumn Bough." On the last step, she stopped humming and ran her finger down the backbone of the cupid on the newel post. He was a crude, squat provincial cupid, carved of gray Montaigne marble. He looked anxious and dyspeptic. Piera poked his belly to see if he would belch. Then all at once she wheeled round and darted up the stairs in a fifth the time it had taken her to come down them. The upstairs hall was dark and smelled of dusty velvet. She listened at her father's door. Silence. Count Orlant was still asleep. On hot days he generally slept away the afternoon on his old leather couch, though he never meant to. Piera went back down the stairs smartly, trip, 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 swung round the newel post using Cupid as a fulcrum, and went off to her great-aunt's room. Auntie, so she was always called, and the servants called her Countess Aunt, was very old. She had been very old during all Piera's life. She had birthdays, like other people, but she could not possibly remember them, as Piera remembered all her birthdays since the 11th one. And what difference could a 95th birthday make? Whether she was 93 or 94 or 95, Auntie sat in her straight-backed chair, wearing a black dress and gray shawl, and sometimes dozed and sometimes did not. Her face was netted with countless dry lines radiating from her mouth and the corners of her eyes. Her features, nose, cheekbones, cheek hollows, were as if obliterated by that network of tiny lines. Most of her teeth were gone, her lips sunken. Her eyes were like her grandniece's eyes, gray, translucent. Auntie was not dozing this afternoon. She looked at Piera with clear gray eyes across the gulf of 80 years.
"Auntie, did you ever dream you could fly?"
"No, my dear."
Auntie usually answered no.
"This afternoon, when I was lying down, I dreamed I could float. All it takes is knowing you can. You just push off from the wall, so, with one finger, holding your breath, and then take long steps, you see? And to change direction, you just push off the wall again. I'm sure I was doing it. I came clear downstairs without touching—shall I hold wool for you?"
Auntie's hands had got too stiff years ago for knitting or embroidery, but she liked to hold needles and wool, or a panel and silk, and doze with them, and she particularly liked to wind the hanks of wool and silk into balls. Pierrot also enjoyed this. She could hold hanks for Auntie for an hour, watching the red or blue or green yarn slip off her parallel hands and gleam in Auntie's stiff, deliberate fingers, winding it round and round and round.
Not now, my dear.
Is it time for your tea?
Auntie said nothing. It was not time for her tea. She dozed, and her grandniece slipped away. She looked into the kitchen, an enormous low room darkened by the oaks outside. The house of Valtorsa, built in 1710, was screened from the lake by trees and faced the valley and the foothills. Old Itale Sorde's notion of building his house right on the water had been one of his foreign fancies. No one was in the kitchen now but Maria the cook, gutting a hen. Pierrot came and looked.
"What's that, Maria?"
"The crop, Contessina."
"All full of seeds, yes. What's that?"
"An egg, Contessina. Didn't you ever see an egg?"
"Not inside a hen. Look, there's more of them."
"It's that old fool Matti. I told him the brown hen with white specks, and he brought the Chiasafonte hen instead. And her head off already, the old fool. She's old, but she was a fine layer. Look there, the bitty eggs, like beads on a necklace."
The stout woman and the girl peered into the blood-scented innards. Maria roused to momentary interest by Pierrot's interest.
"But how do they get there?"
"Why, the he-bird."
Maria shrugged.
"Yes, I know the he-bird," Pierrot murmured.
She sighed, wrinkling her nose at that dry smell of blood.
"Are you going to bake this afternoon, Maria?"
"Thursday afternoon?"
"Oh, I knew you weren't. I just asked. Where's Stasio?"
"In the fields."
"Everybody's in the fields all day. They might as well have died and gone to heaven. I wish winter would come."
Pierrot spun round to make her skirt balloon out, investigated a huge iron soup kettle hanging in a corner of the hearth, then wandered out. Her domain was desolate. All the farm people were getting the late hay in. Maria had nothing to say. Auntie was asleep. The count was asleep. The governess was off on her holiday. It was too dull to stay indoors and too hot to go outdoors. And she could not go to see Laura because Itale was leaving tomorrow, leaving all at once for the city, forever. She wandered to the front room with its drawn blinds, marble fireplace with more marble cupids, its long, shiny, empty floor, and sparse, stiff furniture. The floor looked cool. She knew it was cool and was tempted to lie down on it, flat on her stomach, as she had used to do on hot afternoons. But she was too old, in her garnet skirt and linen blouse, to go crawling on the floor. She curled up on the window seat and peered out between the shutter and the frame at the empty, shady side yard. The whole trouble was that there was nobody to talk to, nobody to understand what she did not understand, nothing to do with the life that filled her, nothing to do. Pierrot sat still, her feet tucked under her, her hand holding aside the corner of the linen blind so that she could see the same dull bit of the yard and the foothills building up towards Sinvilla Mountain. And she was sad, 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 with the dull, deep, immense sadness of August, of a hot, eternal afternoon of August. The Sorda house was also silent, but under the summer trance there was some coming and going, now and then the sound of voices. Itale's bedroom was hot. He had opened the window to get air, indifferent to the bar of fiery sunshine that lay across the floor. He was in shirt sleeves, and his hair, wet with sweat, stuck up in tangles above his forehead. He was sorting through papers, putting most of them back in a tin box, leaving out a few to take with him. Soon done with the task, he shoved the box back under the table and stood up. The first breath of wind broke the day's great stillness. A cat's paw streaked the lake near shore, taking long to disappear, and the topmost paper of the little pile on the desk stirred. He put his hand on it mechanically, then looked down. "Not this time a dream, O Liberty." It was a poem on the Revolution of Naples he had written last winter. His friends in Amictia had thought it very fine. He began to stuff the papers into the valise open on the bed. Metastasio's words to his mistress, sung in the streets of Naples by a people briefly free, went on in his head. "I am not dreaming this time. Non sogno questa volta. Non sogno libertà." Over and over, like the cricket chant, till he stopped listening. Note: Italian, "not a dream this time, not a dream, O Liberty." Lines from La Libertà a Nice, 1733, by Pietro Metastasio, the pseudonym of Italian poet Pietro Antonio Domenico Trapassi, 1698 to 1782. End note. The breath of wind had passed. The bar of sunlight lay across the bare floor, intolerably bright. A knock. Laura came in at his word.
"Here's the linens. Mother's finishing a shirt for you to wear tomorrow."
"All right. Thanks."
"Can I help?"
"All done except for these." He began stuffing the clean shirts into the valise, needing something to occupy him in Laura's presence. Each felt oppressed, unnatural, and aware of the others feeling so.
"Let me. You're folding them all wrong."
"Oh, well." He let Laura pack the shirts.
"Piera said she had a book of yours."
"The Estenskar. Get it from her when she's done with it. You ought to read it. Don't post it to me. It's a contraband edition." He stood looking out the window again. "It's going to be a real storm tonight."
"I hope so."
Laura straightened up and watched with him the slow, faint massing of clouds in the southwest behind the hunter. 10 to 1, Count Orlant hasn't got his hay in from Arley's field. Every year I can remember he's raced a storm for that hay."
"I hope it's a huge storm."
"Why?" There was no one but Itale who could ask her why and smile because he knew the answer. There was no other man to whom she could talk as an equal, whom she could trust absolutely. There were beloved parents, relatives, friends, but one brother only.
"I wish I could go too."
He went on looking at her and finally asked,
"Why?"
In a different tone, a voice full not of unconscious but conscious, regretful love.
"Why are you going?"
"I'm obliged to, Laura."
"I'm obliged not to."
Neither was able to put that fact in question. Among women, all of whom he desired, all of whom baffled and frightened him, among them all there was one sister only.
"Will you go to Evalde, Laura?"
Until he went to college, he and she had gone every year at dawn of the spring equinox across the lake to the Gulf of Evalde, where a river broke from caverns in a high cascade to the lake. On the shore there was a high rock, curiously marked, called the Hermit's Rock. Count Orlant ascribed the markings to druids. Others, dubious of druids, said it marked the place where Saint Italus, the missionary, had preached to the heathen tribes of Val Malafrena. The spirit it roused in the brother and sister was heathen enough. To them, in adolescence, the true year began with that silent course before dawn across the lake and arrival on that shore, a solitary celebration of rock and mist and light above the waters.
"Yes, I will."
"In Falcone?" She nodded. "And you're right."
"Of course. But will you? Real letters? You wrote such stupid letters before you came home."
"I couldn't explain about being under house arrest. Everything got so complicated." Laura was at last getting the whole story of Müller, von Haller, and Gentz. When her mother came in, she and Itale had been laughing. They felt ashamed of laughing on the day before Itale left, knowing that their mother had wept for his going. Laura escaped, and Eleonora showed him the shirt she had ironed herself.
"To wear tomorrow," she said.
She was used to the inadequacies of life, to the shirt ironed because the words cannot be said or will do no good. He was not.
"Mother, you do understand—"
He stopped.
"I think so, dear. I only wish you were happier about it yourself."
She looked into his valise.
"Will you wear your blue coat?"
"How can I be happy if Father—"
"You mustn't hold anger against him, dear."
"I don't. Only if he—"
Itale stammered slightly when he was keyed up.
"If he'd try to understand that I'm trying to do right."
Eleonora was silent. Then she said, mild and tenacious,
"You mustn't hold anger against him, Itale."
"Believe me, I try not to,"
he said with his passionate candor and seriousness, so that she turned to him smiling.
"But if we could only talk to each other, if I could explain to him—"
"I don't know if people can ever really explain," she said. "Not in words, anyway."
She saw he did not believe her. That was all right. She, too, had once believed that people could be entirely honest with one another. She did not consider herself better for having lost that faith. If she were to be entirely honest with her son right now, she would beg him to stay home, not to go. For if he went, he would never come home again. So she repeated,
"Will you wear your blue coat? It'll be cold on the coach in the morning."
He nodded unhappily.
"I want to put up a lunch for you. Eva saved some roast beef," she said.
And at that, the reality of the roast beef, the coach wheels turning, the dust of the road that led away from home, the silence of the dining room where she and Guida and Laura would sit down tomorrow without him, all this threatened her all over again, and she left him hastily so that she could struggle with it alone. He went on down to the boathouse, having time to reset Falcone's tiller, a job he had promised himself to do before he left. The long light was intense on the road and the green hollow lawn above the boathouse. Behind the hunter now, clouds banked heavy. There was a greenish cast to the air over the lake. When the steering was mended, he set to waxing the seats and rail of the boat, wanting to be busy. It was hot and dim in the boathouse, smelling of wax, soaked wood, water weeds. The raw pine roof trembled with webbed, moving reflections of the sunlit water. Men were coming back from haying. He heard their voices on the road above. One went by after the others, singing a song that rose and fell on a few notes in the minor. "Red are the berries on the autumn bough. Sleep, my love, and sleep thee well. The gray dove sings in the forest now. Sleep till thou wilt waken." He finished his job, went up the grassy slope and through the line of poplars to the road. The men from haying in the north field had all gone by, done in good time, for Guida was seldom caught racing a storm for his hay. No one was on the road but old Brown and David Angele, returning from the vineyards, and with them Marta, Astolfe's wife. The men wore somber, shapeless work clothes. Only on feast days would there be any color about their dress, and the vivid white of the heavy embroidered shirt. Brown strode along, long-legged, unhurried, self-contained, like an old animal, taciturn. His strength was that of old age, economical, a wisdom of movement. David Angele, a young man, looked entirely insignificant beside him. On his left, Marta, in garnet red skirt and embroidered blouse, took two steps to his one. She had been a beauty 10 years ago, when she was 20. The smile that creased her cheeks and showed her bad teeth was still radiant, as she said to her landlord's son,
"And you're off again, Domital?"
tomorrow, Marta.
They all knew, of course, that Dom Guide and Dom Ital had quarreled. David Angele glanced slyly at Itale. Brone was silent. Only Marta knew how to continue the dangerous subject with tact.
And it's the King's City you're going to this time. So David Angele says.
So Dom Guide told young Cas, David Angele put in hastily, exculpating himself.
What a grand place it must be,
Marta went on, evidently without the least desire to see it.
People thick as flies on sugar, they say.
But you're not to call it the King's City now, Marta, said the young vintner, again with a sly glance. You know there's no king in these days.
There's the foreign duchess lady you needn't teach me, lad. But I like the sound of the old name. It's how my mother always called it. Ain't I right, uncle?
Aye, said old Brone, striding along.
Itale asked Marta about her three little daughters, which made her laugh. She laughed about them since, as she explained, they couldn't yet give her cause to cry. With Brone, he discussed the state of the grapes and the new planting of Oria vines. He had been Brone's student and disciple in the vineyards all his life. But they were already at the Dower House Road, and Marta said,
You must turn off here. Then I wish you a safe journey and Godspeed, Dom Ital.
Worn and solid, gap-toothed, she gave him her radiant smile. Itale shook hands with David Angele with a warmth that rose from bad conscience at disliking him, and turned last to Brone.
When I come back, Brone...
Aye, you will.
Their eyes met. It seemed to Itale, because he so much desired it to be so, that the old man understood all he meant, knew more than he himself knew, and found no need to say it. So they parted, and he went to the house for supper. They ate early because they must be up early. They did not linger over the meal. When Eva came in from the kitchen to change the blue-ringed plates, her slippers creaking, they looked up at her with relief. But her old face was as gloomy as any of theirs. Guide went out to the stables after supper. The women sat with their sewing in the front room. Itale stood at the windows that looked over the terrace to the lake. The light was strange, the water nearly black, but above Evalde, the long forested ridge unearthly bright against a somber sky. A strong wind blew from the southwest now, breaking the water into netted streaks. Air and lake darkened fast with the night and storm coming on together. Itale turned round and looked at his mother and sister. So they would sit together here, their faces bent to their work, when he was gone, those who kept the house. His mother glanced up at him, as she always did from sewing, with a grave, peaceable look, then said, "It's going to be very pretty, I think. See?" shaking out the goods she was working on, a drift of white stuff. It's her first real evening dress.
Aye, he said, staring at it. I'll go see the Valtorskars, I think. The Count should be in by now.
It's going to storm any minute, isn't it?
I won't stay. Any messages for them?
He went up to his room three steps at a time. He had been 12 when he got tall enough to take the stairs three at a time, he recalled, for a moment as he went, and looked over his bookcase hastily, and took out a small book bound in whitish leather, well-worn, a translation of Dante's Vita Nova, which he had bought in Solari. Note: The New Life, 1295, a collection of poetry and prose by Dante Alighieri, circa 1265 to 1321, on the topic of courtly love, but also because his beloved Beatrice died during the writing, on love as a source of redemption. End note. He sat down with it at his desk, and there in the dusk, wrote on the flyleaf a few words, his name, the date, then slipped it in his pocket and went out. No one was about. The sound of his steps on the path was the only sound. Crickets were silent, birds had left the air.
The wind was down, and the sky dark except for a green streak over San Givan, the last of daylight. As he brought his boat out and set off westward, skirting the shore, it was so quiet that he heard across the breadth of the lake the remote music of the waterfall at Evalde. Then a mutter of thunder. Then the first huge whisper of rain on the slopes across the lake. The sail went slack. The twilight seemed all at once to give place to black night. The noise grew and grew. He felt rain on his hands, on his face, and then the storm was on him, dark and stiff as all the trees of the forests, a roar of rain, a wall of wind, lightning, thunder echoing redoubled off the water. The boom swept right across as Falcone jibbed like mad and ran in towards shore. It took all his strength to hold the wet sail, on which the wind pushed with demented violence. He could not bring the boat back against the wind, and now she bucked and heeled till the sail touched the water. In a half lull, he got the sail down and got out the oars. His clothes clung to him like silk. His hands were so cold with rain and so stiff from fighting the sail that he could hardly feel their grip on the oars. He rowed into the storm, getting through it, if he could not harness it, defeated, immensely happy. On the marble steps of Valtorsa, he took off his hat, poured the water off the brim, got his breath for a minute, and knocked. The Valtorskar's old servant opened the door and stared in wonder.
"Are you drowned, Dom Ital?"
he said at last.
"Come in, come in!"
Count Orlant was shouting from the front room in his unexpectedly strong voice.
"Hoy, who's there? That you, Rodene? What the devil sent you out in this storm?"
He came into the hall. Itale would not come in, saying he was too wet and had to get back home, so Count Orlant wished him good luck and goodbye, there beside the coat racks, earnestly shaking his wet hand while Itale clutched the Vita Nova in the other. He had turned to take his leave when Piera appeared.
"You're going, Itale?"
she said. Her face was bright and startled. The old servant drew back, and she came to the doorway where Itale stood with the rain and wind behind him.
"I wanted to give you this."
He held out the book.
"I wanted to give you something."
She took the book, did not look at it, but at him.
"Did you come in Falcone?"
"I nearly turned her over."
He smiled, self-deriding, exulting. The wind blew in past him, making Piera hug her arms to her sides.
"I must say goodbye, Piera."
"Will you never come back?"
"I'll come back."
She put out her hand. He took it. Their eyes met. She smiled.
"Goodbye, Itale."
"Goodbye."
She did not move to close the door, but stood within the doorway looking at the rain and flashing darkness where he had gone, till old Givan bumbled up and shut the door.
"Look there, that rain! Not stopped yet. Crazy to take a boat out in such a storm."
Piera went down the hall, looked in the living room. Her father and auntie were ensconced there, with yarn skein and astronomical chart. She slipped upstairs to her own room. Curtains hid the darkness. The candlelight was golden and serene. But she heard the sound of the rain, the sound of Itale's voice. He had been wet with rain, wet through, his hand strong and cold. Had he actually come? She shivered. The little book in her hand was cold and slightly damp. She looked down at it and read the title, The New Life. She turned a few pages and saw prose, full of "there is muches" and "wherefores," and verse, "of love so sweetly speaking that all my will is his." The book opened of itself to the flyleaf, and she held it closer to the candle to read what was written there. "Here begins the new life. Piera Valtorskar from Itale Sorde, August 5th, 1825. She sat looking at the words, written clear and black, the capital S blurred from hasty blotting or the rain. She smiled at last, as she had smiled at him, and bent her head and kissed his name.